Behavioral Health Institute for students and adults. It's comprehensive therapeutic services that help people in recovery, and that speaks to our heart and what we do with Faith in Action, and one of the reasons why we wanted to have him here today. Currently serves more than 1,500 students and adults in North and Central Ohio who are impacted by drug and alcohol abuse, along with low income disparities and mental illness. But perhaps we know this gentleman more for his physical prowess on the football field, and maybe we remember some of the things he was able to do as a younger man back in the early 2000s. He was the first freshman running back to start for OSU and be named Big Ten Freshman of the Year, set the freshman rushing and touchdown season record, and solidified his role as a leader on the field. And I think probably most importantly for that season, he did help beat Michigan 14-9, went on to win the national championship by beating Miami 31-24. And we want to invite and welcome to the stage Mr. Maurice Claret.
There you go. Good morning. Good morning. All right. No, me and the pastor was back there talking football and everything else. I almost had too much fun back there. I didn't want to come out. Well, believe it or not, I come to Newark on a regular basis. I was telling the pastor, I'm here twice a week. I do a podcast literally right down the street. And so I'm like a semi-resident of some sorts. Y'all can shake y'all heads, yes. So if you ever want to catch me, I'm at 60 Anthony Drive every Tuesday and Thursday, or Tuesdays and Wednesdays sometimes. But I was just telling the pastor how fortunate that I am, after everything I've been through in my entire life, to just be in a position to go around and share. You know, my life could have been totally different. You know, I'll go and speak all over the country and talk about my experiences only with the purpose of trying to basically help other people. You know, just talk about what I've lived through, what I've gone through. Talk about my childhood. I talk about, you know, decisions made that were right. Talk about things that were made that weren't right. And eventually, how I came to be where I'm at now. Sometimes I help people, sometimes I don't. But I tell jokes, and so I try to be as entertaining as possible to kind of, like, ease the mood, right? But in a nutshell, I'm from Youngstown, Ohio. Grew up in, I like to call it, like, the mid-90s era. And if anybody can remember any stories or words about Youngstown in the mid-90s, it was a very violent time. You had the backside of what was called the mafia in Youngstown. You had, you know, the Crips and Bloods and the gang violence. You had a bunch of murders, and you had a bunch of robberies. And I grew up literally in the midst of all this, not like on the outside skirts of it, but in the midst of it on a street called Ravenwood. Excuse me. So in the process of growing up, I never thought about being a football player. I never thought in a million years that I would go to the NFL, go to Ohio State, or be some premier athlete. I was just playing inside of the neighborhood that I was raised in, just like any other kid, right? But what brought popularity and basically attention to guys in the inner city was guys who got in trouble, right? And so as a young kid, I would get in trouble all the time on purpose, right? If it wasn't fist fights or trying to steal something from the store or just trying to have altercations with my brothers, it would just basically be stuff within that realm. And as a result, I really say that I had three defining moments in my childhood that kind of like basically put me into the direction of football. The first one was that I actually stole a car. It was me and a friend. We go on a joyride. We steal a car, go on a joyride. I was about 11 years old. In the process of stealing the car, we go and get on a high-speed chase. And after the high-speed chase, the police officer catches us, takes us downtown to the Juvenile Justice Center, and basically arrests us. And I'm down there for about 2 or 3 days. I get back out of the juvenile facility. I come back home. And in the process of being at home, I remember my buddies, my cousins, the guys who were in the house, like they were just so happy. Like, you know, what did it look like? You know, what was it like to be locked up? And then, you know, in my head, I like processed that moment as like, this is like the cool thing to get arrested, get in trouble, and to talk about your experience. Like this brought some sort of like bravado or validation, right? So you fast forward that. Obviously, my mother was mad because my older brothers and cousins have basically been doing the same thing, and she pretty much summed it up as, you know, Maurice is going to be doing the same thing that these guys are doing, right? So fast forward that. Maybe about a month and a half later, I actually snuck out and I went to a skating ring event that they had, or a skating party for young junior high kids. And as we get to the skating ring, we end up basically getting into a fist fight with some guys from another side of town. I'm from the south side of town. There were some guys from the north side. There were just a bunch of little kids like having fist fights with all our older brothers and cousins. And there was a big melee. And to make a long story short, they ended up coming out and arresting us. And I was basically taken back down to the juvenile facility. And at this time, I was incarcerated for about 10 days. So I get back out. Now, my mother was a great mother, but she worked all day. She worked about 45 minutes from home. And so she was not able to be there and take care of us and also basically provide for us. You know, you had to choose one or another because my father obviously wasn't there. So fast forward the story, she started to put me in like the YMCA, the Boys and Girls Club, and other different activities for kids, AAU track and AAU basketball, just trying to occupy my time. She said, hey, I need to get my son involved in this stuff. I don't want you to basically be like your older brothers. And so for about a year and a half, I stayed out of trouble. And in my eighth grade year, this is like one event to kind of push me into football, but just to kind of describe my childhood. And so midday comes, my buddy comes down to me, says, hey, Maurice, you know, Terry and them at the end of the block, you know, they're not home, but they have a PlayStation. You know, let's break in the house, let's steal the PlayStation. You know, you can have it sometimes and I can have it sometimes, right? And so I'm thinking like, this is a good idea, right? So we go down the street, we break into the house, and like we were really gonna share a PlayStation, right? it made sense at the time, I'll tell you that. So we go down the street, we break into the house, and unbeknownst to both of us, the gentleman who was in the house, he was asleep. And so as he wakes up and comes down the hallway, I'm sitting on my knee and I'm grabbing the cords out the back of the TV. And as I'm grabbing the cords out the back of the TV, he comes to the door. You know, he says, old stuff, right? Stuff, right? So, you know, he says, old stuff. And he takes out down the hallway. He runs down the steps and he closes the door. And as he closed the door, I run into panic. And I run outside the room and I run down the hallway. And we're literally like on the second story of the house, and I jump out the window head first, bust my head on the window, and eventually bust my head on the ground, and I get up in a full panic, and I run, I trip over the fence, and I bust my head again, and literally ran all the way home. And as a result from that, I go to the hospital, and I ended up going to get staples in my head, and I got 13 staples, and that was the whole reason why I wore number 13. ESPN didn't tell y'all that, right? Yeah, I told this stuff to ESPN, but they didn't include it in the documentary. Right? I'll tell you some more stories they didn't include for probably like a thousand other reasons, right? But I'm also mad, too, at the pastor because they could have told me this was like jeans and T-shirts, right? Like, this would have went a lot better. I don't like suits, I tell you that. Like, I'm like jeans and sneakers type of guy, like in like T-shirts. This would have been like a lot cool. And then I see my man with the big beard and the guns out. I'm like, come on, man. Like a T-shirt was appropriate, right? but that's what happened. You know, that's what happened. And eventually, I went downtown to the juvenile facility, and what actually happened was they put us in the dormitory. It's literally like about two times the size of this. There was a bunch of kids on the floor, and a gentleman by the name of Mr. Roland Smith, and I'll ever forever remember him. He was a correctional officer. He comes and grabs me in the middle of the night. He talks to me and he says, hey, Maurice, you know, I've seen you play basketball, I've seen you play football. And he's just encouraging me to stay out of trouble. And so he's like, hey, man, you know, if I can I get the judge to basically place you on house arrest? Because you come and basically come back and forth with me to high school to lift weights and like let me mentor you throughout the summer. So this is the end of my eighth grade year, transition to the ninth grade. Obviously, I didn't want to go to the state facility that was down here in Columbus. And whatever he said to the judge that next day, or the next week, it actually worked because the judge put me on house arrest, gave me a little ankle monitor in the eighth grade, and basically allowed me to go back and forth to lift weights with Mr. Roland Smith and start to do Bible studies. And he would just like, you know, take me out to grab lunch and talk to me, stuff that basically probably like a father would do with the kid. So as a result from it, I'm going back and forth from weightlifting, I'm doing all of the conditioning with the local high school players, and I was good towards the team that we were playing, but I had no clue that I had a real talent, right? And when I was dominating that practice with my teammates, I just was like, you know, these guys are sorry. You know, I didn't thought like we had a sorry team. I'm just serious, right? Like, and like for note, like we weren't that good anyway, I tell you that. And you know, as fate would have it, I got an opportunity my first game of the season to do a kickoff return, and I ran a kickoff return and eventually got an opportunity to play varsity football as a freshman. And after I had played about two or three games, what actually happened was I started having success on the field, like 140 yards and 230, and then eventually like 160, and I broke my ankle. But what it had done for me was like, man, you know, you can get out your neighborhood. You know, I know a lot of kids grow up these days and they think about professional ball because, like, there's a lot of professionals to look up to now. But me, when I grew up, you know, this was like 90s, like 98, 99, I just thought that going to college was like the best thing. I never thought of being a professional athlete. And so I would see these college coaches come in. I say, man, you know, Maurice, you can take football serious and you can basically get out your neighborhood. Like, that was my only thing, just to get outside my neighborhood, right? So midway through my freshman year, I decided to go to a school called Warren Harding. It was a school on the other side of town who were basically sending guys all around the country to different universities, you know, Ohio State and Texas and, you know, USC and so on and so forth. And as a result from that, I transferred over there. I took football a little bit more serious my sophomore year, had some success, and I eventually had surgery on my ankle because I had a separated tibia and fibula, and they kind of fused them back together, which basically gave me more time to lift weights and study film and things of that nature. And so in my junior year, getting ready to come back, I had five games to play. And within five games, I got about like 1,600 yards, which was a bunch of yards in five games. And I said, man, I took this thing serious and I can like actually do something with football. Like I went from like basically like being like a decent guy in the area. So I said, man, I literally thought that I could be the best in the country from seeing other guys. And so my senior year, I came back just to like for notation purposes. I didn't take school serious. You know, I had been getting pushed through school since like the ninth or 10th grade because I was good in football. And so I go out here, literally my senior year, I have a bunch of success on the field. My senior year, I win the USA Today Player of the Year. I win the high school Heisman. I win Mr. Football for the state of Ohio and everything that you can want to win from a personal standpoint. But, you know, we lost to Cleveland St. Ignatius right before the championship, right? Or right before the championship. And so at this time, and this is a fun fact since we're, you know, by Columbus, Ohio State didn't even offer me a scholarship. Like, that's like this silly thing. Like, I actually called Coach Truss up and I said, hey, Coach Truss, you know, I'm coming to Ohio State. And he was like, you know, we didn't offer you a scholarship. And I said, you know, after this year, you will, trust me, right? and so then when I called him up again, I said, hey, you know, you got a scholarship for me now? Sounds like a lot arrogant back then. And he was like, yeah, you're not going to trade, are you? And I was like, nah. And so I ended up coming back down to Ohio State. And so 2002, I came down like most of these kids come down, dreaming to, you know, just one day play college football again, never believing that I can go pro, but I just wanted to basically come to Ohio State, play here, and basically whatever happened after that basically happened. And so I come down, work my tail off, and eventually, and this is kind of like where the story starts, eventually I end up gaining like the starting running back as a freshman. And so I go out here the first game, and I believe that like I'm just like Joe Blow walking into the stadium. You know, the day before the game, I stay up all night. I literally don't go to sleep. I was listening to, you know, them old school Walkmans, you know what I'm saying? Like listening to a CD player all night, listening to my favorite songs, and just literally just nervous at like what's going to take place the next day. And I go out here in the first game and I have a bunch of success, you know, 175 yards and three touchdowns. And so, you know, after we're done with the game, I remember coming outside the game and, you know, at that time they had, you know, kids hanging around, you getting autographs, and that's when they had the roll-up cameras, you had to snap them, you know what I'm saying? I remember taking a bunch of those pictures and signing all type of memorabilia, and I just thought it was like the coolest thing in the world. But what actually had happened, which I believe kind of like shaped and twisted everything, I remember my brothers and my cousins, they had come to the game and they was like, yo, Reese, you know, let's go out, let's go in and basically go to, there's a club off of 161, it was called Studio 69, for 161 in the Morris Road area. And it was like, you know, let's go out and have fun. And prior to me going to college, you know, I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't do anything. You know, I was like the total gym rat. You know, I lift weights all day, condition all day, watch film all day. I was like one of those guys who just do what he has to do, go back to his dorm room and come back. You know, there was nothing of like any distraction to me. I was like totally committed to being a football player. I was like literally like a football head. And so after this, I was like, okay, I'm famous now. Now I'm supposed to be doing famous stuff. Like, even though this wasn't my thing, I was like, nah, I can just do famous stuff, right? I tell you, there's a lot of guys like this. They're just like, now that I'm famous, I can do famous stuff, right? So I go to the party, And so now they say, hey, you come in, you're in VIP. So I said, okay, I've never been in VIP before. This is kind of cool, right? So I come into the VIP section, and now you have champagne, you have alcohol, you have beer, you have everybody kind of like having a good time. And so now there's women around. And so now they're like, okay, he's cute. And I said, okay, cool. I wasn't cute last week, you know what I'm saying? So, but this week, I look a little better because I play football, right? And so, you know, next thing you know, I'm in this environment, and what I can say without a shadow of a doubt, like the environment caught me. I was like, wow, this is cool. And I wanted to basically like experience that more often. So we come back to school the next week, and I can remember just that feeling I had of wanting to experience a party again. I was like, man, I can't wait to go out here to beat, you know, San Jose State so we can go out on the weekend and have fun. And so that thing happened week 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And I can remember this was right before we played Wisconsin. Coach Trussell called me and he said, hey, Maurice, you know, like everything is cool. You know, we're winning and everything. But, you know, you're not showing up to class. You're not showing up to watch extra film. You're not doing all the stuff that you had done to get to this point. Like, you know, can you please slow down? And so as an 18-year-old kid, like, it just wasn't registering. You know, I can walk into the, you know, the Walgreens or the Kroger and see my face on the magazine. You know, to a kid from the hood, I was like, man, I made it. What is this guy talking about? You know what I'm saying? Like, and I was trying to talk to the pastor before. This is context, you know what I'm saying? When you grew up in the hood and, you know, and just like, this is just self-admittingly, you know, I seen probably before the age of 12, three people get killed in front of my face. You know, our house getting shot up, like 50 bullets go through our house. This is like stuff that's documented on our 30 for 30. You know, seeing my mother get beat on by my father, you know what I'm saying? Like seeing your brothers go in and out of jail, your family members go in and out of jail. So to make it to college, that was like the NFL to me. I felt like I had made it. Like if this doesn't work out, like I've lived past anything that I ever thought was possible for my life. You follow me? Like, so that was like a victory to me. And there's a lot of kids you may see act foolishly, but like they may be getting past what they ever thought was possible. You know, this was a real thing in my life that I thought was going on. So I just didn't pay attention to Coach Trussell. So what ended up happening was I ended up going through the whole season again, just kind of rocking and rolling through the season. And then we get to the last game of the season. And, you know, we go out there, we beat Michigan, right? We beat them up. And then we're going to the national championship. And so at this time, I'm getting ready to go to the national championship. And I really couldn't conceive of all of this, what was going on. You know, just couldn't conceive that we were having all the success very fast. And so we go out here, we win the national championship, and literally after the national championship, I was like, wow. I said, man, I've accomplished a whole lot within 13 months. And if you can just imagine this, right? Everything that you can want to do from a personal level in high school, you accomplish, you know, which is a lot, right? And then 13 months later, you accomplish everything you can want to accomplish from a collegiate standpoint. You know, that's a lot of success very fast. I'm about to add another layer on here. And at this time, LeBron was in high school. And LeBron's a year younger than me, but we had known each other for a while. And so he's like, hey, Reese, you know, we have a basketball season coming up. You know, do you want to come to some of our games? Because they were selling out college arenas. And so I was like, okay, go to class or go watch LeBron? You know what I'm saying? I was like, I'm going to watch LeBron. You know, at this time, he had Nike chasing him. You want some shoes? Here go 10 pair of shoes. You want some jogging suits? Here go 20 jogging suits. At this time, you know, you had 50 Cent and Jay-Z. These were like rappers coming up. You know, you want to go on tour with these guys? Let's go on tour. And so I was like really unfocused when I was supposed to be at college on campus. And so I can remember even going to my academic advisor, Darren Meeker. You know, I remember going to Darren. I said, man, you know, I'm going to the NFL. I don't need to take school serious anymore. And I had scouted out a group of classes, right? And it was officiating golf, officiating softball, women's studies, and African-American studies. And I go to him and I say, hey, you know, let me take these classes because, you know, I'm not just going to take school real serious. And he has stopped me. He said, hey, Maurice, man, you know, slow down. I don't want you to do this because at some point you'll have to come and clean this stuff back up. And so I just really didn't believe what he was saying to me. I was like, man, I'm going to the NFL. You know, I'll make millions of dollars. Like, I'll be A-OK. Like, no problem, right? He was trying to warn me and get me from being in my own way. So you fast forward the story. We're going into our second season. We have everybody coming back. I think we're about to go win another championship. I think I'm about to go out here and win the Heisman Trophy. I really believed this in my head. I had trained hard the whole summer, and the NCAA had basically said, hey, let's come in. Let's give you an investigation. You have all these violations that you've basically committed. So they come in, and I'm believing in my head that we'll just be investigated for like 2 or 3 days, and they'll go away and come back during the season. And, you know, I'll be playing by that time. But what actually happened was they came in during, like, they'll come in on Monday, and whatever they investigate from 8 in the morning until 12, they'll go investigate it from, like, you know, 12 to 3. Then they'll call you in Tuesday, and they'll call you on Wednesday, they'll call you on Thursday. And I was like, man, these guys keep on digging, right? And I was like, man, every question that these guys keep on asking, like, they know I'm guilty, they just, like, want me to tell them myself, right? And so at the end of the investigation, after, like, two or three weeks, right, I remember they came in, and when I came in, they had, like, all these lawyers sitting across from me. I was like, yeah, this ain't good. You know what I'm saying? I can remember, it was like, yeah, don't show up to where you used to show up. Show up to the Shotten Saints Center. And then I walk in, you see all these people sitting across. I was like, all right. They're not telling me I'm back on the team. This is, like, about to be bad. And so I came in, and, like, they read this whole long list of things. And I just was like, man, get to the point. Like, I just know what's about to go on. And, like, I was, like, very frustrated. And they said, you know, we suspend you indefinitely, right? And I was like, well, I know what suspend means, but I don't know what indefinitely means. You know what I'm saying? I was like, what does that mean? And the lawyer was like, basically, they'll get back to you. You know what I'm saying? And I just thought it was, like, the silliest thing. And so when they suspended me, this is what I must say is the time that kind of, like, broke my adult spirit. You know, this is the first time in my life that I had been depressed. And when I explained it, I always explain, like, you know, from a football standpoint, if I ever was struggling with a game, I can go back and watch film. I can go to the weight room. I can go to the trainer to get a better knee. I can go, you know, lift better weights for posterior chain muscles. You know, I can do better conditioning. I can get better from a physical standpoint. But never in my life, in my lifetime, did I understand how to deal with the emotion of depression, right? I never understood how to deal with loneliness. And so if you can just take all of that success and then you're put into a situation where you can't go to your locker room or to the Woody Hayes facility with your teammates. You can't go to the same classes you've been through. You get your scholarship check cut in half. So it's like somebody getting their pay cut in half. And basically, you have to re-enroll as a regular student. And so for me, this was tough because I couldn't do any of the work anyway. You know, I had to have a tutor to help me do the work, right? My socialization was my teammates. And so now I'm disconnected from my teammates. You follow me? Right, so if everybody in here, like, so get your pay cut in half, lose your friends, and then basically get put into a new job that you know that you don't have the skills to do. I don't care who you are, that's tough. Then you put that on a 19-year-old kid, that's a lot of emotional stuff going on, and, you know, from the outside looking in, you're, like, looking at, like, this is the kid messing up, but when you look at it, this is a lot. You know, this is a lot. You know, my mother couldn't, you know, help me to navigate this. I didn't have a father, and so what do you do? And what I did was, like, I went right back to the nightclubs. I'm trying to alter my feelings. So I'm stressed out. I'm depressed. Let me get high. Let me forget about this stuff, right? So I'm watching the second season go by. I'm watching these guys on TV. That stuff is doing nothing but making me depressed, making me stressed, and it feels like life is passing me by. You follow me? Right? I feel like life is just passing me by, right? So next thing you know, I'm out in Vegas at a banquet with Jim Brown, because Jim Brown had helped me through my process. And so Jim Brown sees me out in Vegas, and he brings me to the side. And he says, hey, Maurice, you know, I seen you in September. This is maybe February now. He said, man, you're not the same person. He said, man, I need you to come out to L.A. Let me put a supportive structure around you. He had a group called Amir I Can. Let me put a structure around you and help you to get better, right? So it took me about a week to get to L.A. I fly to L.A. By the time I get to L.A., Jim Brown's in North Carolina or South Carolina for whatever reason. And so he's telling me, like, hey, when I get back to town, like, basically we'll work with you. So by the time he comes back to town, I had called some friends who I knew that were in L.A., and I basically had been partying. You know, I was out at the beach. I was on Sunset. You know, in L.A., you can smoke weed all day and all night. Nobody cares, right? In Ohio, people call you, like, a junkie or a loser, right? L.A. is just, like, the thing to do. You know what I'm saying? And so I was like, this is kind of cool. Like, I'm just doing the same thing that I was doing in Ohio, but I'm doing it in Los Angeles County with no judgment. There's no Ohio State football fans who are looking at me as if they have, like, expectations of me being Maurice Claret. And it was just basically giving me a place to hide. So this took place for about 2 years. And, like, being real, I thought football was over. I thought everything was over with football. I thought I was done. I was just totally cool with just going on and living my life. I was like, okay, you had one great season. You did more than you ever thought you can do. Like, go on and just basically live your life, right? So lo and behold, January of 2005 comes, and the NFL calls me and they say, hey, we would like for you to come to the combine, right? And so prior to this, I hadn't been working out. You know, I was doing, like Planet Fitness workouts, you know what I'm saying? Like, jog on the treadmill, lift a couple weights, that's it. You know what I'm saying? Nothing real serious. And I thought in my head that I would go to the combine And I would basically just work out very well. Like, I thought that, hey, I've been doing this my whole life. I'll catch the football. I'll run fast. I'll jump high. I'll do all of these things, even though I wasn't preparing for them. So I go to the combine, and to make a long story short, I ran a 40-yard dash two times. I had ran 4.8s, which are very slow. And basically, I started embarrassing myself, right? So after I ran two slow 4.8s in a 40-yard dash, I said, okay, maybe I'll go do some skill work, run through some cones, do some agility drills, and after I do this stuff, maybe the coaches will be impressed, right? So I go out here, I'm doing the skill drills, running through the cones, and as I'm running through the cones, literally my hamstrings are getting tight, my lower back is getting tight, my groin is getting tight, and it's visible that I'm out of shape. You know, I can't get through the drills, I'm starting to get frustrated, and after I'm doing this, the coach is yelling at me, and the coaches yell at you just to see if they can, like, prod and push you, and just to kind of see, like, mentally and emotionally, where you're at. But me, I'm getting frustrated as he's doing this. And so midway through the workout, I stop and I start to argue with the coach, right? And I can visibly see the other guys are like, yo, you're tripping. But in my head, I had basically, in my head, I had been on the streets for 2 years. So somewhere in my mind, I thought that I was a gangster, right? I thought that I was like this gangster who was playing football. So what ended up happening was I left the football field. I went back to the hotel. And after that, I went back to California in February, and I thought, hey, football is really over. I just bombed this whole workout, right? So I go out here. This is fast forward. That was February. April comes around. I'm not really doing nothing. Still just living in Southern California. I come around to April. The draft is on TV. My mother comes out in town. She's just out there just to get away, not to really watch the draft, but the draft so happened to be on TV. The guys are watching with me, and as I see the draft comes on, I'm starting to see families and players and people get up and, hey, here's my jersey, this is who I am. You know, I got drafted first, second, third, fourth, and fifth, and I didn't realize with me that that whole deal that was going on kind of made me jealous, you know. And I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people in here, and we all, like, have moments that we know kind of passed us by. And when you're seeing people get drafted, you're like, man, you know, I wish I would have made more of this moment. You know, man, you know, I used to play with him. I was better than him. He's getting drafted right now. And just internally, that was like probably one of the worst feelings of my life, to see like my moment. You know, follow me with that one. Like, everybody has a moment that they wish that they would have had done better or secured better. And, you know, you wish things would have turned out a bit different. And that was like one of my major moments that I wish had turned out differently for me. So next thing you know, I get in the car midway through the second round, and at this time it's visible that I can see my mother. She was like, man, you know, my son, like, didn't make it. And she thought that I would basically be the person or the vehicle to kind of get us out of that situation. And so the next thing you know, I'm driving around, and I get a call from Mike Shanahan. He calls me, he says, hey, Maurice, we have the 101st pick in the third round. He said, we would like to make you a Denver Bronco. And so I'm like, all right, cool. You know, this is, like, amazing. I'm going to be a Denver Bronco. I'm drafted to the NFL. Like, I thought this was the coolest thing in the world. But the further I got down the freeway, I remember myself, like, getting anxiety, like, major anxiety. And I knew the anxiety was just basically from me not being prepared. You know, I didn't condition. I didn't lift weights. I didn't do all the things that basically it would take to be a professional athlete. And I knew at some point, because I played enough football in my life, I knew at some point, just through repetition, you know, you can't take all the hits and you can't do everything you're supposed to be doing if you've not put the preparation in. It's just a fact of life, right? At some point in the fight, like, somebody's conditioning shows up and somebody's conditioning doesn't. And I just knew at some point that this would happen on the football field. So the next thing you know, I go out to Denver, and maybe after the first 2 or 3 weeks, I knew it was over, right? My body couldn't take it, couldn't get out to bed. Guys are hitting me. I can't recover the way I used to. I'm just not in shape like I used to be, right? So I remember the coach coming to me, and he said, hey, Maurice, you know, we're starting to see that you're struggling. You know, can you sit down with the sports psychologist, right? We can start to see, like, mentally you're having a hard time adjusting, right? So I said, okay, you know, I'm having a hard time adjusting, but I don't want to sit down with somebody and talk about my problems. Like, I just didn't think that that was a thing, right? So I pushed my help away. So they said, okay, all right, go back out here, right? And at that time, I remember vividly, after they had that conversation, I remember we had Jerry Rice on our team that year. I was number 20. Jerry Rice was number 19, so our lockers are right by each other. And we also had John Lynch, right? So I used to see these guys prepare every day, lift weights every day, condition every day. And I said, hey, maybe if I just follow these guys, like, I could start to be a better player. So I started to follow them, and I started to be a better player somewhat, but I still like to go out with the young guys, still like to party, still like to come in real late. And I was, like, teetering on the fence of, like, halfway professional, halfway guy who likes to party and have fun. So we're getting ready to go to the preseason. I'm starting to show flashes of what I was doing at Ohio State because now I'm lifting weights. I'm getting up in the morning. I'm at least starting to move in the right direction somewhat. And we were getting ready to play the Colts. This was the preseason game. And I remember they came to me and they said, "Hey, Maurice, man, can you please consider going on a practice squad? And while you're on the practice squad, start to meet with the sports psychologist every week. Like, she can really help you." And I was like, man, I don't think I want to go to the practice squad. Like, I process that as you're not good enough rather than we're trying to help you. You know what I'm saying? They were trying to help me and put me up and shelve me for longer years in the NFL, but I basically pushed them away, pushed my help away, and I also pushed the sports psychologist away. I was like, I don't want to talk about my problems. I'm like, I'm okay. I got my thing, right? So we go out here, we play the game, and then the next morning they give me a ring and they say, "Hey, Maurice, you know, we have to cut you. Can you bring all your team issue stuff, your playbook and everything that we've given you? We basically have to part ways with you." So they parted ways with me, and I thought that I was at a low before. I went like below that low, you know, so I went like into a deeper thing of depression, because now, like, to get embarrassed to, like, in your house is one thing, but to get embarrassed on TV in front of everybody, that's like something totally different. You know, and that's why I'm like a lot more empathetic with people. Like, when they get bashed publicly, that's a lot for a person to go through where you're just getting hammered on TV. You know, nobody has anything good to say about you. Everybody has a strong opinion about what you should have done or things like that. There's just a lot emotionally for any kid, even for any adult, for that matter, just a lot to go through, right? And so I go to California, and I remember as clear as yesterday, I'm sitting inside of a party. And I remember I just felt like very alone, like very, very alone. Felt isolated, felt alone. I didn't hear the music. I didn't see the people around me. I was like, man, something is like really wrong with me personally, where I don't feel like connected to life. Like I didn't have like that spark or just like that purpose that I had playing football. So I got on the phone with Coach Truss. So I called Coach Truss. I said, "Hey, man, look, man, I'm lost. I don't know what to do. Hey, man, can we please sit down and talk? Can you please help to give me some direction?" So I flew back to Ohio. I got away from California. At least I knew California was bad for me. California wasn't about to take me back to where I used to be. I'm like a blue-collar guy. Youngstown and Newark is literally probably the same thing. Blue-collar town, blue-collar people, it's the same deal, right? This is like where I'm from. So, excuse me, I ended up going to talk to him. And in the process of talking to him, we talked about a lot. We talked about our history. But in the process of doing that, he gave me like two things to do. He said, "Maurice, I need you to go back to school, and I also need you to get in better shape. You know, when you get in better shape, you can basically go out here and play football in NFL Europe and basically work your way back to the NFL. And at that time, NFL Europe had tryouts in December. And he said, "But I also need you to go back to school to occupy your time." So the first thing was possible because I was able to go back and start working out. But the second thing was like not possible because I probably at that time had a 10th grade education. Like a formal 10th grade education. So any of the real work that they would have put in front of me, I literally couldn't do it. Like literally couldn't do anything that they would have put in front of me other than, you know, just like, you know, the basic, you know, nonsense classes that they had me in. So next thing you know, I start to go out here. I start to get in shape. But now I don't re-enroll back to school and I have a tremendous amount of free time on my hands. And so the only thing I remember was the same mentality of the kid who was breaking in houses, who was stealing cars, and who was basically getting in trouble, that same kid resurfaced in my life. And now at 34, I can look back on it and I can say, okay, when Mr. Rowland came and got me out of the juvenile facility, he didn't correct behavior. He just let me know I was good in football. You're able to like basically pursue life through a football vehicle. But once the football was gone, that same little kid who basically never developed showed back up. It makes sense, right? So that same kid showed back up at 22 now, right? So I couldn't feed myself. I had no skills to be employable. I didn't know what I was doing, and at this time, basically, I started committing crimes. And on December 31st, 2005, I committed a robbery downtown in Columbus. So I got the robbery case, I'm kicked out of the NFL, I'm kicked out of college, and probably 3 weeks after that, Ashley, they fell asleep and they're still in the bed right now, I found out Ashley, who was my lady, she was pregnant. And so now this is like as much success as I had on one end of the spectrum, like I'm having as equal amount of like disappointment in my life on the backside. Like it seems like one bad decision happens after another, right? So all of 2006, I can't say I remember too much. You know, I don't know if anybody's ever been here where you're restless and sleepless, sleeping 2 hours a night, 1 hour a night, tossing and turning. Like, being sleep deprived is probably one of the most aggravating things, not being able to get 5-6 hours of sleep. I had no clue that I would ever even learn to sleep again. Like, that's a real thing. I know, like, I didn't come here to talk about sleep, but if you've ever been sleep deprived, like, it's a very irritating thing. So all of 2006, I could just say, I don't even remember that person, but obviously the big arrest happened, right? And I ended up coming down to Columbus. It was August 9th, the big arrest that happened on TV. I told ESPN, but they didn't include it in the story. And so I was coming down Columbus. I was coming down 70, and I realized that I got off at the wrong exit. I got off on Bryce Row, but I was going in the wrong direction. And as I get off on Bryce Row, I come to the stoplight. And once I come to the stoplight, I say, okay, it's about 3 in the morning. Nobody's out here. I'll go ahead and make a U-turn. I don't feel like waiting at the light, right? So as I make the U-turn, there was a Home Depot. If you know what Bryce Road, familiar with it, there's a Home Depot off of Bryce Road. I make the U-turn. There's a police officer kind of like sitting in that area with him by the Home Depot. And so as I make the U-turn and start to go the other direction, he basically comes out, puts on his lights, and I'm like, oh, man, right? And I'm like, oh, man, obviously, yeah, right? It wasn't funny then. So he puts on his lights, and I'm like, okay, this is about to be like a situation, right? So I pull up to the side of the road, and for whatever reason, I thought about, remember the show Cops? I remember that? So in the episode of Cops, I remember a guy pulled to the side of the road, police officer gets out, he walks up on the car, and as he walks up on the car, he pulls off, trying to get a head start, right? But I forgot that everybody gets caught on Cops, right? I got to dismiss that whole memo, right? So I'm thinking like, this is going to work. So I pull to the side, he pulls to the side, he gets out the car, he walks up on the car, and obviously I had weapons with me. So as he walks up on the car, I pull off. And so I'm pulling off and I'm going over to Bryce Road Bridge, getting on 70 East, that is now. He's running back to the car. He's flying up over the hill, get behind me. I'm on an on-ramp. I'm probably about 25 yards ahead. Next thing you know, I look in the mirror, he's right behind me. And he's right behind me because I'm trying to get away in a Hyundai Santa Fe. Right. Yes, right. So I don't suggest running from the police, but even if you do, Hyundai Santa Fe, you know what I'm saying? It's not the getaway car, right? All right, that's like a V4, right? Four cylinder, right? So I'm going down the road. So as I'm going down the road, I'm driving, and mind you, prior to this, I had never been further than Bryce Road. I didn't even know what 256 was. So I'm going towards Blacklick. After I go towards Blacklick, I'm going towards, you know, 256-ish, and I'm starting to go down 70 where like the new Amazon Center is at now, right? But before the Amazon Center, there was a bunch of woods, right? And so I'm from Youngstown, Ohio. Y'all get where I'm going with this? Brothers don't do the woods, right? So I always say a joke, brothers don't do the woods, Caucasians don't do the hoods, right? If I offended anybody, sorry. I like to joke. Pastor, sorry, I joke, wherever you at. I'm a funny guy, I'm not serious. I say nothing serious. If I offended you, sorry, right? Sorry, right? We don't, right? I just don't. Let me turn the other way, right? So this was serious. I said, I'm not about to run in the woods. I don't know what's out there. So like, I don't like deer, raccoon, possum, nothing. I don't, right? Spiders, nothing, right? So I don't, no. Come from the city, like that's nothing, right? So I decided to make a U-turn, and as I'm coming back in the other direction, this is a serious story. There was a police officer that had blocked off the freeway, and he was sitting inside of the row with spike strips. So he threw the spike strips out, they bust the tires, and the wheels that were grinding on the concrete, and you know, the car started to shake. And I can remember as vivid as yesterday, and you can go back and look at the film from the 30 for 30, my mother described it. I remember calling my mother, I said, Mom, I'm about to get out the car and have a shootout with the police because like I'm just ready to die. Like this was a real thing. I was just like ready to die. Like so many bad decisions had came in my life that I was like, man, I'm just like done with this. Like I just like don't want to live no more, right? And so that's hard for some people to admit, but some people have been down in a barrel where you're just like, man, I'm over this. Like I just rather do something else. Like it's easier to say now, but if you would have caught me in that moment, you could have probably seen the expression on my face. Like, it was like a real serious thing. Like, I was like, I'm over this, right? So you fast forward, I call it like my divine intervention moment. Like, something, whatever my mother said to me worked. I end up pulling off the side of the road. They get me out of the car, you know, obviously arrest me, and they take me down to the Columbus County Jail. And when I get down there, obviously, you know, the first day, it was the weekend. No, it was a Wednesday. So I don't think they see me immediately. And it was how, like, probably like the next week, I went back to the judge. And the judge was like, hey, you know, I've seen you in a different state from playing football. You're not the same person who I seen before. They said, you know, before we move forward with our trial, I need you to go and basically get a mental health evaluation. And I was like, oh, really? You know what I'm saying? And, you know, what I forgot to tell you all was that when I was at Ohio State, they tried to get me mental health assistance, right? Tried to get it for me, right? They was like, hey, you've been through a lot growing up. You need mental health assistance while you're here, right? Because when you play the sports or when you play football, so much of what you do is driven off of trauma. You know, when you watch all these TV shows with ESPN, they talk about the kids who come from the neighborhood, mother got beaten up, father was beaten on her, kids coming from the drugs, kids coming from hood. All this stuff is trauma, and you use that stuff to basically go play. And so they were trying to get me that assistance, right? When I go to the Denver, they were trying to sit me down with a psychologist to mentally work with me, right? It took me to go all the way to prison for them to force me to basically work with somebody and to get mental health assistance. And I was like, wow, this is like crazy. Like, I was rejecting all of this, but I should have got this stuff years ago, right? So the next thing you know, I end up basically talking to the psychiatrist, and I got diagnosed with severe anxiety and severe depression, right? So they put me on mental health medication. I've been on medication since 2006 now, September through 2006 is 12 years now, and literally probably the best thing that ever happened to me. Literally the best thing that ever happened to me. And I remember the first 7 months of my incarceration, the cell was like a 9x4, so it wasn't too much bigger than the basic area up here. And I was locked down 23 hours out the day, and you have 20 minutes to go, basically go to another cell to work out, another 20 minutes to go from to the telephone where you're locked in another cage, and another 20 minutes to basically take a shower. And a shower is basically like a water fountain. It's really a water fountain over the top of your head. It's not like something that's spraying you. And I remember over the first 7 months, you know, you got three pair of underwear, three T-shirts, and you know, a few pair of socks. And, you know, it's just crazy to believe the same place that you're urinating in and doing a number two in. Like, this is the same place you're drinking water out of and washing your clothes when they get a little stinky. And I just was like, wow, my life has, like, really changed. And in the process of that, you know, I think the only thing that you're doing is, like, trying to figure out, like, how did you get yourself in this situation? You know, and for the love of God, I couldn't understand it. I was like, you know, I'm here, you know, and just couldn't understand, you know, why I was doing what I was doing. I just had no rhyme or reason. You know, I had a bunch of isolation. I would have a bunch of people writing me letters, returning letters, but I had no clue, right? So in the process of doing that, I always say it was the best thing that happened to me being inside of that cell. There was a gentleman getting out of the federal facility, and he was being transported through the Columbus County Jail, and he had a book, a small 70-page read. It was called As a Man Thinketh, right? And so independently from school, I've never read a book like prior to this, right? Never read a book in my life. And so he had gave me the book, and he said, man, you know, I just got home from doing 12 years, but this book helped to change my life, or just helped to change my mind. And I was like, all right, cool, let me read the book, right? And so you're locked down for 23 hours out the day, you have no TV, you have a book and a notepad, you're gonna read this book 1,000 times, I promise you that, right? So I just start to read the book, and I would read over and over again. I would get a dictionary and the words I didn't understand, I would just read and read and read. And what it started teaching me was that your thoughts are things, like your thoughts create your reality. And so after I would read, I would start going back to my life, and I was like, man, you know, where does your mentality come from? Or like, who do you believe that you are? Like, what are you planting in your mind? You know, you listen to shoot 'em up, bang, bang, kill, kill, you're gonna shoot 'em up, bang, bang, kill, kill at some point. You listen to get high, get drunk, smoke weed all day, you're gonna get high, get drunk, smoke weed all day. You're around people who wanna be thugging all day, you're gonna be around people who thug all day. Like, your thoughts create your reality. And so it became interesting. I said, man, life isn't like some random series of events. Life is literally what you make it. Whatever you think and wanna create into this world is what you make. What you give attention to grows. And so when I started talking about this, it said nothing can come from corn but corn. Nothing can come from nettles but nettles. Until thought is linked with purpose, nothing intelligent should ever happen. And when I started reading that stuff, I was like, man, this stuff like sounds simple, but I get it, right? And so at this point, the judge sentenced me to 7.5 years in the Ohio State Penitentiary. So I leave here, I leave Columbus, I go to Toledo, and this was the second best thing that happened to me after like my train was going into the right direction. right? I'm in prison, but I knew something right was happening. I could feel it, right? I don't care, like, even if you're in a bad situation, you can start to see when things are turning. Like, stuff just feels right. I think your feelings are, like, the most, like, realest thing that you have. I think that's, like, our intuition that we don't pay attention to or that we neglect or think that life just, like, happens. Like, your feelings, like, guide you in the right direction. And there was a gentleman by the name of Mr. Keller Conte, and this is very, very important, like, to my transformation. He was from Sierra Leone. He had came here and made something of himself, but he was the warden of the prison. He said, Maurice, my father was a chief in Sierra Leone for about 15 years. He said, when people would get in trouble in the village, he would bring the guys closer to the village, figure out what's going wrong, fix them, and send them back out. He said, in America, when you guys mess up or get in trouble, America's taught to throw you all away. And I was like, wow. He said, it's not over. He said, I want you to get yourself better here, right? He said, I'm going to put you a bunch of psychosocial and emotional supportive courses. Prior to this, I never heard this stuff before. Prior to this, I was like, football and parties. That was it, right? And so he said, you need to develop yourself here. So the next thing you know, he started putting me in stuff like responsible adult culture, cage of rage, thinking for a change, anger management, substance abuse classes, reading the book Ishmael Bey, A Long Way Gone, and literally started to work on the social emotional love languages, 7 different love languages, started to work on different parts of me like I had never worked on before, you know, talking about my emotions. And in a nutshell, believe it or not, it was a therapeutic space. The same mental health assistance that they were trying to get me before, I was just doing in a prison, like in a different environment, right? And for 4 years, I was basically locked down for 20 hours out of the day. So I was in Toledo, Ohio from 2006 to 2010. I was locked in a housing unit for 20 hours out of the day with about another 2,200 or about 600 men inside the pod that we were in, right? So as a result from that, I would have different people who were literally Buckeye fans. And I promise you, it was 8 girls, and they were 8 senior citizens, and I called them my golden girls. And they would literally, like, send me cards every week. It was like they had, like, prison ministry. They would send me, like, $10 to $15 here, and they would order books for me. But there was this catalog called Bargain Books, and Bargain Books was a thing where you can order books about a third of the price. And so I said, okay, I don't have anything to do. I'm locked down in the cell all day. I'm going to just order books and start reading. So next thing you know, got my dictionary. I started ordering books, and I just start reading and reading and reading and reading and reading. At that point, I went back to Ohio University. I did some correspondence courses. And the next thing you know, I was in this cell, but I started to grow. Like, I was coming outside the cell. I was able to articulate myself. I was able to talk to people. People would say stuff to me. I can process information different. And I was like, man, you just never gave yourself a chance. Like, you're really smart. You articulate. Like, you just never gave that side a chance. You just thought that the only thing that you can be was a football player. Like, I was just selling myself short, right? So the next thing you know, I began to just explore and just read everything that I get my hands on, papers. I used to fall in love with Charlie Rose. Charlie Rose used to have, like, the cool talk show. I would stay up for that and just watch, like, interviews and watch how people conducted themselves. And when I was in prison, I ended up starting to basically host a Toastmasters class and basically host other programs that basically I had went through and basically got help from. And after 4 years, they basically let me out. You know, they let me out, and, like, I was basically back to being a free man. I went back to Ohio State. I knocked out more coursework, and I was proud of it this time because I didn't have to manipulate a tutor to basically do my work for me. I was able to go and do my work myself and study myself, and the grades that I had earned, so it had a different level of significance. But in 2010, I ended up, going to Omaha, Nebraska. And when I went to Nebraska, there was a lot that happened, and eventually to why I'm, like, even kind of here. And I remember getting out of prison was weird because I was talking to the pastor before this. You know, in prison, you don't talk to nobody. Like, believe it or not, everything is, like, super isolated. And if we don't know each other, just, like, us guys talking to each other. So, like, socially, I was awkward. Like, I just couldn't talk to anybody. And if you can just imagine prison, you know, in prison, you wake up, you have to be as, like, hard as a rock, as that wall, when you wake up. Like, you're super intense every single day because just the violence. You know, I've seen guys get stabbed up. I've seen guys get beat in their bed at 6:30 in the morning. I've seen guys get hot water and baby oil boiled on the face and thrown on them. I've seen guys get killed over basketball games. Guys, you know, spitting in faces. Guys get raped. So you wake up when you come out of this environment, you're super tough, super hard. You know what I mean? So for me, socially, it was awkward. And so I came back out in 2010, and I can remember being in a house with my family, and I would walk around in the house with my family, like, I just, like, had no clue of, like, what to do. I didn't know how to talk. I didn't, like, okay, you want to watch TV? Like, let's turn to cartoons. You know what I'm saying? I thought that was, like, a social piece. And I remember I would go work out at the gym, and I would see a pastor there, and his name was Pastor Todd Dockson. And so Pastor Doxson was an old receiver of Kurt Warner's back in the day, and he played football, and he played for the Jets for a few years, but he was a pastor at a church. And I was like, okay, this seems like a pretty cool dude, seems like somebody like I can talk to. I said, yo, pastor, you know, can we sit down and can we talk? And I was like, you know, I don't know how to basically interact with my family, and you have kids, like, can you teach me that, right? And so next thing you know, we're working out in the gym, and he's like, yeah, man, let me talk to you. And so after that, we go down to the locker room, and after we're in the locker room, my man comes over to me and he sits down. He's like, man, but, you know, if I talk to you about raising somebody, I have to talk to you about Jesus, right? And I was like, okay, we can talk about Jesus, but you got to go put your clothes on, man. You know what I'm saying? So, and so, like, it is locker room, I was like, this is a little weird, you know what I'm saying? Like, nobody want to see the naked pastor, you know what I'm saying? And so we end up getting together, you know, and prior to this, the only thing I had ever read out of the Bible was Proverbs in Ecclesiastics, and I think that most people gravitate to those because it's very easy to understand. You know, I had no clue of what salvation was. I just understood that, you know, like, I understand Proverbs, I do understand Ecclesiastics, I understand how it applies to my life, but there's a lot of stuff biblically I don't know about. And he was like, Maurice, that's cool. You're not supposed to know everything. Like, that's why you're here to learn. And literally over like an 8 to 9 week period, we would have like a men's group of like going through what salvation was and literally why Christ died for our sins. And so it was in 2014 in June that I actually gave my life to the Lord. And he was like, hey, like, let me start there and get you going in the right direction. And I said, like, okay, like, so what's supposed to happen now? Because I thought, like, okay, like, you walk out the house the next day and it's like something cool is supposed to happen. And he said, no, you know what I'm saying? He was like, you're just the standard where how you're supposed to live has been lifted. You're supposed to live with character and live Christ-like. And so if you know me a little bit, I'll use a lot of graphic language sometimes. And I was like, you know, pastor, that's like one of my hardest things because I'm used to talking like I'm in the locker room all the time. But he was like, you know, in due time, like, you'll basically be better. And so after that, you know, I start going to church on a consistent basis and just being involved. And that was a lot of service work that I was doing. But in the process of that, I was going around the country speaking a bunch because the 30 for 30 had came out. We filmed it in 2013. I left Omaha in 2012. 2013 came. December of 2013 had come. And the film came out, and I basically started speaking all over the country. I spoke at probably about 300 different events, you know, through universities and churches and businesses and everything else. And I was really on the road a whole lot. I was able to get into some different activities. I was in transportation for a while. I was, you know, running trucks with a company. I was contracted to do some transportation and packaging work. Yeah, I know, right? I was contracted to do some transportation and packaging work and literally just started to raise my family and just do more of what I'm doing now and really speak to different issues that I thought were relevant in my life, either when I'm speaking to student athletes, speaking to guys, like having a relationship with the Lord and not being like a one way. I thought that, you know, if you had a relationship with the Lord, you had to lose your personality, but I found out that that wasn't true. And just basically living, I would call it living Christ-like the way I live now. But in 2015, I opened up what is called the Red Zone, or I started to investigate what is called the Red Zone. I went to a speaking engagement in Toledo, Ohio. They had a bunch of student athletes, and I spoke to them and told my story. And after I told them my story, there was a gentleman doing an activity. It was a CBT activity, a cognitive behavioral therapy course, and it was the activating event, the mind activity, the body reaction, the consequence. And I was like, yo, you know, like, where did you get this information from? Like, you know, this is like prison stuff. And he was like, okay. He was like, you know, this is behavioral health. And I said, man, this stuff, learning how to think and learning how to basically be like one with my emotions and learning how to work through personal issues, this is the stuff that saved my life in prison. I said, I wish that this stuff can be more available to people. And he said, man, I have a behavioral health agency. And at this time, I had about 12 trucks, and I was doing packaging business with Cardinal Health. And so I was like living my life and speaking all the time. But I said, man, this stuff felt like it was right. This felt like me. This felt like stuff that I can get up every day and be excited about. You know, transportation, I was just throwing boxes on the truck and shipping them, but it wasn't like working with anybody. I used to have a bunch of free time on my hands. And so what ended up happening was that I called it the Red Zone, and the Red Zone was literally for a purpose because I said, hey, if you have a mental health issue or an addiction issue, you're literally in the red zone of your life, and you need some assistance and you need some help. Identical to football, that if somebody's in the red zone, you have to score or stop somebody from scoring. And obviously, I played football, and most people know me from that stage. And so I went through like an 8-month period of getting policies and procedures together, and I opened up our facility in 2016. and went back to Youngstown. I connected with Coach Trussell again, and we started to work with people in, with different school-based services and adults from an outpatient service, and I was just basically sharing my experience from my benefits of therapy and how they had worked. And there was also another component that helped with me. I was able to basically explain to kids, inner-city Black kids and Hispanic kids who are in Youngstown, that therapy wasn't a bad thing. And I think if I've accomplished anything, it was to like introduce therapy to people or to build skills to people who wouldn't normally engage in services that would basically help them get themselves together. And from there, we've kind of gotten ourselves on track. We service a ton of people in the Trotwood area, Columbus, Marion, Youngstown, and also Warren. We probably have like about 150 people on staff right now. And I just enjoy what I do. You know, I speak a ton around the country. I'm usually telling jokes on somebody's stage, but I'm very fortunate, more than anything in my life, to be at peace. I'm very fortunate to wake up every day. I'm very fortunate to even share my experience. And I don't say this in any other way than if it wasn't for the Lord actually guiding my steps, it wasn't for the Lord actually like removing barriers for me and me sort of like coming in line and doing what I'm supposed to be doing now, like I wouldn't be here. And so like I don't have like an amazing story, you know, just kind of like what I've been through. And you can catch me every day on Twitter or Instagram. I get up every day, you know, and do the same stuff. I wake up at 4:30 in the morning. I'm on a track or in the gym at 5. I pray and meditate every morning. I'm a huge goal person. I go down to my basement. I write on whiteboards every single morning, like every morning, like it's my religion. I write about what I'm going through or what I'm doing. I sit down and meditate and literally connect myself. When I run, I think I get a runner's high, and I'm meditating and connecting with the Lord. I think that physical activity, prayer, and meditation, they all go together. I'm like a huge mind, body, and spirit person, and now I'm doing stuff that's more preventative to assist with my mental health, my mental stability, and just the condition of my life. And I'm fortunate, you know, there's been people who have been Buckeye fans who've given me a lot of opportunities as to what I'm doing now. So I'm even fortunate that you all will sit here and listen to me tell jokes. If they weren't funny, at least like act like they were, you know what I'm saying? But that's pretty much it. That's my story, and thank you all for having me.